You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest in the studio is Stephen Pett, the author of a new novel called Sirens, which has just been published in the Vintage Contemporary series from Random House. It's an unusual novel set in the southwest of America. Stephen was previously the author of one book called Pulpit of Bones, a book of poetry that came out from Morrow in, what was it, 1975?
That's right.
That's 15 years. Has this been a 15-year project, Sirens?
No, it's been an 8-year project, though. And so for 7 years I was writing stories. I wrote another novel, a long novel, Pioneer Saga, Utah Pioneer Saga, that is still in a drawer that needs a lot of attention. I'll get those pioneers off the trail.
Now, the novel has as its pretext an easy-to-say, what we would call in the film business, an easy-to-pitch idea. A young man, Carlos Cade, comes back to avenge himself on a childhood friend, now the governor of Utah, who had, when they were both children, inadvertently killed a playfellow of theirs. Now, I've noticed that when poets turn to novel writing, there is some tendency to turn toward somewhat pulpy formats like that. I think of Dennis Johnson's novel Angels, for instance. Why is that, do you suppose?
Well, that's an interesting observation. James Dickey's book Deliverance, which has all kinds of sensationalistic aspects. I don't know exactly why that is, unless we are looking for an engine that will easily drive the language so that then we're really free to concentrate more on language, that the plot is moving itself along. I don't know that here I'd agree that this resorts to that sort of pulpier engine. I think that one of the things I hope a reader will come to realize is that my narrator here is focusing on that as a way of diverting attention from something that he did that he really feels much more deeply about. And so it was just the most convenient way to layer the book, I think, initially.
I think it's also that sometimes in the in a novel, let's not say pulp, in a noirish novel, there are verbal effects and access to verbal effects and intensities that the more normal range of novels just evade entirely, that may in fact be more congenial to poetry. The effects are more sudden, sometimes more jarring, and certainly more colloquial.
I think that's right. And I was drawn maybe to this narrator for that reason. He allowed for those passionate extremes. I like to sort of concentrate on the nouns and the verbs of this prose, and he allowed for that. He's a guy who's a real nouns and verbsy kind of guy, and the things that he's feeling allow for that kind of excess, and I enjoyed it.
The poems, too, in Pulpit of Bones are set in the southwest, in the desert, and they have a kind of dreamlike hallucinatory intensity, not very distinctly not narrative poems. Was the attempt, because here too the language has that incandescent lyricism, was the attempt to work in narrative forms a labor at first for you?
I don't believe so. No, I think it came quite naturally. In fact, I think I'm a writer who puts on masks quite easily. I don't write autobiographically very often. When I meet people, I was thinking about this today, and how I might sort of differ from other writers. I think I tend to imagine how I would exist in their shell, how I would function, how sort of their senses would feed my consciousness. And when a lot of other writers, I think, might imagine how it would be to interact with them at length. And so masks come easily to me, and I'm interested in masks, I think. One of the things that intrigued me about this narration, and that intrigues me about a first-person narrative in general, is the possibility of deceit. And he isn't the most trustworthy of narrators, and he's deceiving himself. And I like the possibility of those sorts of resonances and that kind of, I don't know, what you call a multi-vocality or something. I mean, just a range.
Well, it's interesting because although you're a general unreliable narrator, classically the narrator of The Good Soldier, is usually telling you a story in which he may be bending the truth, but most of the other characters are relatively on the natch. But in this book, you know, while he is an evader and a liar, he is hardly an exception in the community that he lives in. Carlos Cade is talking about a group of people in the Southwest who've, you know, done goo in their childhood and have had successive disjarrings subsequently.
Well, it's true. In fact, he may be the only character among them who is bothered by this construction of self. He, in fact, at one point says, the secret is to invent yourself before somebody else does. Everyone else is sort of inventing him or herself, but doesn't seem to be troubled by it. It's a novel that is set in Utah, which is maybe distinct from other areas in the Southwest in that the controlling culture has sort of invented itself. And anyone who's lived there for a while comes to recognize that, I think. So it's maybe appropriate to the world he finds himself in that that's the way people would operate.
There's an extraordinary quote from Eugene V. Debs that I read recently, who says, if there is a criminal class, I am of it. And there is a quality in this novel of identity, if with anything at all, with that class of people. In fact, what comedy there is in the book, and it's more an austere, a stark, a shocking book than it is a comic book, is about the Disney Americans, the American babies, the kind of untroubled good citizens who wander around the streets and from whom Carlos Cade, in the novel Sirens by my guest Stephen Pett, from whom Carlos Cade feels a severe alienation. What is the attraction of the criminal class?
Well, in this case, I think I turned to a character like Cade because, one, I had worked around a lot of people like Cade who seemed to have trouble locating themselves in any particular value system. I don't know that I'd feel comfortable calling it a criminal class, but it certainly is a kind of amoral class. And that
maybe post-moral.
Yeah, post-moral. That's an interesting observation. I think that's true. And it's something that I had noted, and I wanted to find a character who embodied that in the extreme to demonstrate certain things that I'd noted about the American sensibility of my time, whatever. But he seems to be not wicked so much as just reactive. He's driven to things that he'd never planned to do and might later regret, but nonetheless, as many Americans often do, finds himself in some pretty awkward and uncomfortable circumstances.
Now, when I thought of scenes from this novel, and I'm not speaking in any judgmental or comparative way, but just the emotional sphere of some of the scenes in this novel, I more frequently thought of movies than of other novels. I thought of Nightmare Alley, for instance, or Girl Crazy, when Carl is on an electric chair, bits of static electricity rattling from his hands and his teeth and electrocuting a chameleon that's put on his very elaborately costumed collar. I thought, too, of Cape Fear, the story of Jack Cady, Robert Mitchum, who comes back home, an ex-con, to threaten the attorney who put him originally in jail. To what extent does the movie imagination inform this book?
That's difficult to say. I don't think, as I wrote this, that I really was drawn to think of too many movies. I don't tend to anchor my imagination in the movies, I don't think.
No, the writing is not movie kind of writing. It's much thicker and resonant than you'd find in the movie, but the kind of scene shaping seemed to be very cinematic.
That's probably so. I took several creative writing courses along the way, and I think the course that may have influenced my writing as much as any other was a course in filmmaking. And in the editing process, I discovered a lot about economy and about the way a narrative can move with grace and with clarity. And so that I think maybe the way I economize, the way I compress, is quite cinematic and sort of Hitchcockian, and it's kind of storyboard-like blocking out in the way it moves.
Now, this novel has an unusual structure to some extent in that it juxtaposes regularly past and present. The two move side by side, and toward, as the book continues, in the latter half of the book, we see very starkly how much of the book rides around a certain repetition compulsion. The characters are reenacting parts of a pattern from which they're actively failing to escape. I'm curious, was that the plan of the book when you started?
Yes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Did you think about Faulkner, the Wild Palms?
I'm glad that you mentioned Faulkner, because I think if there is a sort of major literary influence, that's where it is. For lots of different reasons, but certainly structurally in that sense. In terms of voice, I think here's a character who is constructing himself in a voice that, if you stop and really think about it, might not be entirely plausible, but I hope communicates this character pretty well. It's always amazed me that Faulkner was able to wrestle these Mississippians into available form with the language that he used, and it's one of the things I've sort of tried to parrot in some ways, or at least I'm jealous of.
Does a novelist set out to, I'm curious here, many of these characters, we won't call them the criminal class, we'll call them post-moral, but their behavior is frightening, and the language in which they express their casual intentions to one another is extremely threatening. Now, one doesn't think of a writer as having a simple-minded disapproval, but neither is neutrality all that easy a stance toward these characters. What is your stance off the page toward the goings-on in this novel, Sirens?
Well, I tried to maintain a kind of neutrality. I tried to allow these people to move across the page on their own. Actually, this novel, it came from several different sources, but one of the things that sort of inspired Cade was some obscene telephone calls that my wife was getting from an unemployed guy we knew in the neighborhood. And we couldn't come out and say, we know you were doing this, but we were quite sure that he was the one, and I was irate, had no place to turn that sort of feeling, and I thought, gee, what's it like? What drives someone to do something like that? And Cade was born. There were a lot of times when I really didn't like him, but I tried to hang in there and stick with it in a kind of thinking of Raskolnikov along the way, and other characters, and so there are a lot of things he does that I disapprove of, but I tried to let him go.
Now, this book, Sirens, from the Vintage Contemporary series, comes encased in some extraordinary praise. We've got Annie Dillard on the cover, and within, Rick DeMarinis, Lee K. Abbott, Michael Martone. On the back cover, Frederick Bush and Jim Crumley. is this the result of many, many writing programs?
No, I'm glad you asked that. In fact, that was one of the more anxious times in this book's life when it went out for quotes, when it was circulated to various writers. I had no idea how people would respond, and I was delighted at how positive these responses were and really bowled over with the generosity of a lot of these writers. They didn't have to say anything. And yet here came these letters, and often letters came to me from them saying how much they'd like this book. James Crumley wrote me a long letter on the side to carry on, and it was pretty exciting stuff. So no, these aren't this wasn't political. These are all
no cronyism on the cover of Sirens.
No, I'll say that loud and clear.
I want to recommend that listeners pick up a copy of Sirens, a really iridescent and interesting moral novel that does more than I've seen in any recent novel with the southwestern landscape. Sirens by Stephen Pat. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
My second guest today is Jeffrey Wolfe, author most recently of The Final Club from Knopf. It's his, I believe, fifth novel.
Yes.
And he's also been the author of two distinguished books of nonfiction, Black Sun and The Duke of Deception. I started to read you with Black Sun mostly because I was fascinated by the famous schizophrenic imagery of its title, and noticed that what with that and the memoir of your father with Providence, there's a good deal of suicidal and violent repression forming the texture of the things you choose to write about. Do you say why? Why?
Well, first of all, I seem to be very slow-witted in seeing what the boss themes of my own books have been. When I wrote Black Sun, which is a book about somebody who made himself up in many ways, who turned himself from a Boston Brahmin into a poet, a would-be poet of the 1920s, Harry Crosby. I followed that book with a recollection of my father, who certainly made himself up because he was a con man, and made himself up out of whole cloth, became something other than what he had been. And it wasn't until it wasn't until after The Duke of Deception had been published that somebody pointed out to me that I seemed to be writing about. I seem to be writing about people who made themselves up out of nothing, who treated themselves as tabula rasa. So I'm a slow-witted person about the thematic progressions of my books. It is true, however, to return to your question about violence, suicide, and particularly death, that I take it as part of the business of a writer, or certainly the business of myself as a writer, to attempt to imagine the unimaginable. So I try the hard things for myself. I put devils on the wall. I try and picture them. I try and see what it would be like. I was preoccupied for a long time with the deaths of my children, who have not died. They're fine in great health, but I can't imagine how I would deal with it, so I've tried to imagine it.
Because I found myself wondering in the course of reading The Final Cub, this book which is about a young man who attends Princeton, not the regular Princeton student, not the post-prep school smoothie, but a young man from Seattle who comes to Princeton, encounters the joining of the eating clubs, and has his life in many ways shaped by Princeton. But the book begins with a scene in which the young man's mother has woken him up and virtually asks him which of the two of his parents is to die. She has a gun. Will she shoot his father, who's been unfaithful, or will she kill herself? The beginning struck me as being very Geoffrey Wolfe, but I wondered what, if anything, joins that material to the considerations about Princeton.
I have had, it's probably a stylistic tick of mine that I write what I would call parentheses books. They start and end with a grand event, and the whole middle of the book is an elaboration on the consequences of on the consequences of the event that began the book. Now, in The Final Club, I was interested in those things that make a life change irrevocably. It's a conventional thing, I think, for writers, or at least it ought to be a conventional thing for writers to be preoccupied with, is that the world is one way before this event takes place and it's another way afterward. Now, the grand event that begins The Final Club, that choice that he's asked to make, which he diffuses, he manages to diffuse, nobody dies that night, is a life-changing event for him. Afterwards, the life-changing events that occur to him in the long course of the novel seem superficially to be superficial and petty. Often, they are being snubbed, for example, and it's my conviction that whatever it is that changes a life, either a death or a snub, either a snub given or a snub returned, is still a life-changing event. But that prepares for the truly life-changing event that comes at the very end of the book, the catastrophe, a catastrophe of death that comes at the end of the book. But I am preoccupied principally with those moments when the world is one way before and another way afterward.
One of the people to whom the book is dedicated, Larry Holland, was a teacher of mine at the Johns Hopkins University, a very noble man who unfortunately, unhappily, later died nobly saving a young man from drowning at Breadloaf in Vermont. In Dr. Holland, I saw something very different from many other people at Johns Hopkins. Hugh Kenner was absent-minded and brilliant. Some of the others were martinets and very, very stern. Still others had the newfangled deconstructionist thing, and they were marching drill routines on it. But Holland had a kind of tortured gentility that I've associated subsequently with Princeton and places like it. Does it seem echt Princeton?
He carried the Ur Princeton wound in many ways. He was a product as an undergraduate of that place. He was treated badly by the place. He treated his students nobly. At the time that he taught there, which is when I was a student there from 1956 to 1960, which is also my hero's time, although my hero is a very different character and a much better character than I was, he was a man obsessed with excellence at a time when undergraduates were parlor snakes and bully boys and couldn't begin to appreciate the quality of his passion. They were certainly intellectually equipped to understand his fixations, but his obsession they put no value on. And he fought a long and wasting battle in order to encourage passion in those students whom he willed himself to love, and finally had to give it up and go elsewhere.
I'm talking to Jeffrey Wolff, the author of The Final Club, most recent of his novels published by Alfred Knopf. It's that quality in Holland of sort of tortured self-recrimination that one needn't have had personal conversations with him to recognize. One saw them on his face, that very much defined the atmosphere, the tone of feeling in this book as well, although I did not see any character based ostensibly on him.
There is a... I suppose if the novel is about anything, it's about the quality of discriminations, and discriminations that are both noble and coarse, the kinds of discriminations one makes when one chooses one word instead of another, that kind of discrimination. Then the coarser discrimination in which some teachers engage, saying, of course, Hawthorne is better than Melville, Melville's better than Hawthorne. And then the coarsest of all, the gross discriminations that are the discriminations of blood, stud, book, family, or the kind that says, who makes a better broadcloth shirt, J. Press or Brooks Brothers, that consumer's union of who makes the best toaster oven, those kinds of discriminations. And all of those were pervasive at Princeton. But the atmosphere in a place like Princeton, and Princeton's not unique in this, although the world would be probably a better place if it were, is that American notion of manifest destiny, that we are destined to be number one, that whole number one mentality, who wins, who loses, that sense that there isn't room enough in the world for all kinds of people, there's only room for winners and losers. And Princeton, to a fault, I think embraced that dogma or that faith that there was such a thing as number one and that we were it.
I've been talking to Jeffrey Wolff, the author of The Final Club, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for asking me here.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books, to the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and bold.